Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry with 23 years in the business. Joe's a leading community activist as well and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7311. Hey, Ed Fallon with you here. This week's Fallon Forum, we're going to be rocking and rolling here shortly. I want to send a quick shout out to the Des Moines Iowa Session for our bumper music. My first guest today, a stranger to nobody here in the Des Moines Metro, former Mayor Frank County, also the longest serving mayor in the history of the city, and also a longtime climate activist. Frank, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And you've also been to many of the previous COPs, the UN climate summits. You've been to, what, three or four of them, five of them?
Yeah, quite a few.
Quite a few. Lost count.
Yeah.
I want to look back at those COP summits. But first, let's look at the one that just concluded in Brazil. Some are saying very, very disappointing. What's your take on the outcome of this year's COP?
I think it's always good when people from around the world get together and register their concerns, which is what this is all about in terms of climate. And unfortunately, at this one, despite the immense advocacy for multi-level action, it didn't come out. It sort of missed its opportunity to, shall we say, institutionalize finance and support for multi-levels of government to work together to actually begin achieving some things. I mean, there's always goals and things that people talk about that should be done, but I think a lot of people were disappointed. And of course, unfortunately, it was local government and a few state-level representatives representing the United States because the federal government, for whatever reason, did not come.
For whatever reason. Well, because maybe the president is a climate denier. I quoted Cristina Figueres last week, and maybe you know her, very instrumental person in the previous round of COPs. She said, child bambino, she said, regarding Trump's refusal to attend the summits, basically, bye baby. If you don't want to come, you don't want to come. And then she and others saying that, hey, maybe this is going to go a lot better without the U.S. here. We really don't need the U.S. to move forward on climate action. I don't know if that's true or not, because it doesn't look like, COP moved the conversation forward very, very ambitiously.
Well, I agree. I think that there were some major presentations, including a lot of the natives from South America who came and talked about the necessity to acknowledge what's going on globally and talk about the rainforests and with the destruction that's occurring for development and also because of the huge change in climate with heat and other things that it is destroying huge portions of the rainforest.
And the Amazon is one of the key tipping points. And if it moves from being a rainforest to a savanna, which is kind of looking like the direction it's heading right now, and you couple that with other tipping points like melting Arctic ice, rising sea temperatures, the death of the coral reefs, and you've got a major catastrophe rolling forward at an ever-increasing speed. And, you know, it just seems like more and more people around the world get this. It's embarrassing that we have a president who is in denial of it. But it looks to me, you know, from what my take on COP, Frank, was that, again, Saudi Arabia and Russia played a key role. I mean, two big petro states played a key role in making sure that nothing significant happened.
True. And, you know, they have worked to that end for a number of these COPs, including some of the ones that, you know, as you pointed out, that I've attended. However, it always is uplifting to see so many people in so many different areas. I mean, the organization that I represented, which was ICLEI.
What does that stand for?
Originally known as the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. Now they're Cities for Sustainability. But we've got over 2,500 members to that organization from around the world. And there are concerns that are coming from all these members and trying to all of us come together to raise our voices, to have those other higher levels of government acknowledge, A, what's going on, and B, to acknowledge also that it's the local governments that have to respond to these disasters. Mm. They happen someplace, whether it's Des Moines, Iowa, or whether it's New Orleans, or whether it's other places around the world, including Jamaica and whatever, because of some of these climate significant events that have happened. And we need to have the acknowledgement that we're the ones that are, A, need to prepare for it, need to respond to the businesses, to the people, to protect them, not only today, but for generations in the future.
And we need to take responsibility for the reality that we have caused a lion's share of the global warming that is impacting people around the world.
True.
Yeah, and that's a hard pill to swallow.
Well, you know, I think it is that education and the science that has discovered the problem. And one of the things that is not being recognized in Washington at the moment is the science.
Mm, right.
Whether it's, quite frankly, climate, or whether it's medical, or whether it's so many other things. Mm. Science is out there to tell us what's going on. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And when you take down all the measurements, it's really tough to feel what's going on in the moment or be able to project it in terms of direction. And there's moments when I feel like there are those that are trying to do that on purpose.
Yeah, well, and trying to do it on purpose, so fossil fuel companies and petro states reliant on them can continue to get rich that way. And I think one point that Cristina Figueres made that I thought was pretty astute was that, you know, these dinosaurs, if I can call them that, people who are living in the past in terms of policy, in terms of energy, are going to be left behind, because more than anywhere in the world right now, China is kicking butt when it comes to renewable energy. In terms of manufacturing solar panels and other forms of renewable production. And, you know, the developing world is eating that stuff up. And we're going to be left behind as China becomes the dominant force in terms of the new age of energy. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a lot of places, and we've seen it even here in Iowa with, you know, the windmills that are going up, and a lot of those, you know, were manufactured, quite frankly, with the blades and everything right here in Iowa.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's some resistance to that at this moment from certain sectors, and, you know, we need to do more of that and to look at wind and solar and hydro and all those things that are, quite frankly, we'll call it non-polluting, to our environments. And to turn our backs on those and try to play them down and switch back to coal and gas and oil is really, to me, a huge mistake.
Yeah.
And keeping us going, as you pointed out earlier, in the wrong direction to continue to, we'll just say, warm the planet.
And one thing I learned from my recent 220-mile Save America March, it took me through, 9 different counties. One of them was Adair County, the county seat of Greenfield. And I walked by so many wind turbines and learned from one of my hosts that there were somewhere over 450 wind turbines in Adair County.
Ooh.
And, a lot of the concern, there are legitimate concerns about shadow flicker, about the impact on migrating birds, on the environment, the landscape itself, one concern being the red lights that flash all the time at night. Little concerns like that, but they're big problems if you're the one living next to them. But I was really glad to know that a lot of these problems were being addressed. There's an approach now to dealing with the red lights that instead of having them flash all the time, have them be motion detected.
Hmm.
Go off only when there's a plane or something anywhere in the vicinity. And again, a lot of farmers, landowners, are making money on these turbines. They're getting, $8,000 to $10,000 a year per turbine, which is a heck of a lot better than a one-time payment you get from an oil company that runs a pipeline through your land. So, and it looks like a lot of the opposition to the installation of these wind turbines has kind of subsided. And so, I think, like you said, it's an up-and-coming technology that has a lot more promise than coal, oil, or natural gas.
And absolutely. And back to, watching this happen during my time in office, and my first COP actually was Copenhagen.
And Copenhagen.
Copenhagen, yeah. But we went there, and I got to tell you, the expectations were so high for really positive outcomes. And, as you walk down the streets in Copenhagen, there were demonstrations. They weren't against what we were doing, they were all in support.
Yeah.
There were youth out there. There were farmers out there. There were all kinds of stuff talking about raising things more environmentally friendly. We should eat foods that are more healthy and would help the health and well-being of citizens all around the world. And there were literally a couple of days over 200,000 people out.
Mm.
We'll say protesting in support
in favor,
of what was going on.
And I think we saw that in Paris as well in 2015. That's the one COP that I came close to attending,
I remember you were there. But the thing was that happened in Copenhagen, while there was all the talk and everything that was happening, and the United States showed up and participated, but nothing came out of it.
Hmm.
And I remember in 2012, we were having a meeting of our local government group, and we were in Seoul, Korea, and talking about the upcoming circumstances with the UN and what we should be doing as local governments. And it was interesting to me to listen as you're sitting in a room with the mayor of Seoul and the mayor of Paris and the mayor of London and the mayor of Rio de Janeiro and the mayor of Copenhagen and people who really had participated in a lot of things environmentally and had pushed it. And they were talking about the Kyoto Protocol running out at the end of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting that they were talking about, well, let's get together and we're going to have a local government voice in this when the group puts together the plan for the new protocol.
Mm.
And, unless anybody has anything else, we're going to go on and we're going to send that out to you and we want your input. And I put my hand up and I said, wait a minute. I said, when is it that this is going to happen? He said, well, we think the next chance is going to be in Paris. And so we'll, you know, get that out to you and we'll get the input back. And I said, when do you think this draft will come out? They said, well, probably, you know, Paris is going to be in November of 15. And so it'll probably come out first or second quarter of 15. And I got to tell you, here was Des Moines, Iowa, standing up with all these cities. And I stood up and I said, you've got to be kidding me. I said, we're going to wait to the first or second quarter of 2015 on something that's going to be introduced in 15. I said, we saw what happened in Copenhagen. Local government has to speak out. And I'll bet you there's a few people in this room that know heads of state. And I'm looking at the mayor of Paris. I know he does. And the mayor of London. I know he does. And I know the mayor of Copenhagen does. And Rio does too. We need to start today.
And did they?
And I sat down, and it was dead silence. And but the mayor of Helsinki put his hand up, and they called on him, and he said, I'm with him. And pretty soon the whole room was, and we started.
That's great.
The mayors, yeah, to do it. And actually, we had our own COP in Paris at City Hall, and we were getting better media coverage than the COP was out at the airport. And but I think we had over 400 mayors that showed up and signed on to our own deal. And I think that that in part was what caused the outcome to create the Paris Climate Agreement.
And probably the most positive outcome to date, including what just came out of Brazil. But I mean, is there a future in these COPs actually getting to the root of the problem and coming up with a firm commitment to moving beyond fossil fuels? I mean, the next one is, again, a year away, but and we have to keep going, obviously. But I think recently you floated an idea that maybe it's time to kind of decentralize the whole COP process and localize these conversations and localize the commitments. Now, tell me a little bit more about that, Frank.
Well, the idea is to put together what we call a local COP.
Mm-hmm.
And so you bring our community together, which we did a little bit when we talked about putting our sustainability office in the city, and we went around and, you know, did our DSM plan. And it's those kinds of events where you bring the whole community together. You talk about the science, you talk about how we're all in this together and what we all can do. And hopefully not only people like us that, you know, have been here a while, but future generations, you get them involved. Everybody from high school students, that there's a number of high schools that have their own environmental committees and whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you bring everybody together to understand what we're doing. Look at the risks that are in your community. And look at the opportunities that we have to, A, switch to, let's say, less carbon-based future, and to look at the opportunities on also preparing for those extreme events that happen and what it is that we can do, and try to sort out where the finance is going to come from to make some of these things happen.
And do you think there's willpower in the leadership of Des Moines, for example, to take that seriously and move forward with it?
Well, I'm hopeful, and I think that there's members of the leadership that are committed to that kind of positive outcomes, and let's hopeful that we can get the rest of it to do it. But I think if we have a total community voice, you know, not just you and I out there, you know, beating the drum, but that we can get the whole orchestra to come together and convince the corporate side as well that we're all in this together. Let's work together. Let's plan together. Let's think together. Let's figure out how we're going to finance together and really demonstrate how positive local voices can make positive things happen.
So one more question. Again, this program is broadcasted all, you know, in different parts of the country, but just take Iowa, a mid-sized state with a population of about 3 million. How many local cops would you envision being ideal as units that could really move forward on this conversation in a state this size?
Well, you know, you have to look at it where it could happen, but the local cops, I think, certainly Des Moines ought to do one. I think all the urban areas in this state should do them, of which what there are 8 or 10.
Depending how you define urban, yes.
Yeah, but I would think, you know, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Dubuque, Davenport, Waterloo, Sioux City. There's been a lot of interest in the past in even Fort Dodge and places like that to do certain things. Mm-hmm. But show sort of a plan and share it to any and all communities that want to try to put these sorts of things together. Right. Because so many communities are at risk for some of the unfortunate things that are happening, mm-hmm. Whether it's strictly with the global warming and the heat and those cycles, but also
flooding, water. Drought, yeah.
You know, as you know, we've got huge water problems, and I think we have to promote.
Yeah. Well, Frank,
gathering the science,
yeah,
and gathering the information, and let's share it, and hopefully.
Well, Frank, I really, really appreciate you joining us. I think we're gonna have to have you back in 2026 to see assess how much progress has been made toward the next generation of COPES, either the international one we've all become familiar with, or the local ones that we think might have some real promise. Folks, Frank County's been my guest. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. It's great to be here, and keep up the broadcast.
Back in a minute, folks, Mark Klipsman's going to join me. We're going to be talking about jet fuel made from rendered animal fat. We'll see where that goes back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors and partners, including Catholic Peace Ministry. Catholic Peace Ministry promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrom Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrom and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry. Hey, Ed Fallon with you here, folks, and I'd like to welcome to the program Mark Klipsham, architect, occasional radio DJ, and I think, can I call you a philosopher?
Sure, and active builder actually started building clubhouses when I was about six.
Clubhouses, yeah.
Well, that's where I learned about leaky roofs.
So, hey, what?
50 years.
We're going to talk about a bunch of things, but I want to start with your architectural take on the demolition of the east wing of the White House and the construction of the White House ballroom. I'm sure that you've been vying for the contract to build that, right?
Oh, I did rapidly, sure. Nothing like good clients to work with.
Right, Trump would never backstab a customer.
Yeah,
okay. So anyway, what do you think? The cost has been an issue for sure.
Well, my job is to be a critical thinker and crunch numbers. And possibly the simplest math I could come up with was 300. It started out as 200 million. It went to 300 million. Might get us up 100% overrun, 50% overrun to begin with. Increase 90,000 square feet. Okay, I'm a little calculator here. $3,333 a square foot. So if I were to build a 1,000 square foot home like this, it would go on the market for $3.3 million. In comparison, by the way, the Fed building that Trump gives Powell grief over, ancient building, renovations, incredibly expensive, federal, D.C., the whole bit, $1,900 a square foot.
$1,900. Okay.
Yeah, after the overrun. So this is, you know, marble and limestone and lead paint removal and all that kind of stuff.
Who's building this thing anyhow? Do we know?
The White House, the ballroom?
Yeah, I mean, who are the contractors involved in getting rich off this overpriced?
No, that's not who's getting rich. This is my opinion.
Okay.
Having been in the biz for a while. Remember, this is not government money. This is private money.
Well,
built on public land. There's a lot here. That means there's no oversight. There's no accountability. The GOA is not government of Office of Accountability. Is not. Nobody's paying attention to this except Trump and the people with the money, right?
Right.
So, in that, you could literally build the Taj Mahal for less than this per square foot, or La Sagrada Familia by Antonio Gaudi in Barcelona. They figured that at around $400 to $450 million for the whole cathedral. Rebuilding, not Ramshans, what burned ancient cathedral. That is much less per square foot. It just boggles my mind. So as an architect, I would say, wow, client, either somebody's taking you for a ride here or something. Something's going on. Yeah. I would have to dig into it, but of course, I'm not allowed to do
well,
that.
You know, the fact that it's being built with private donors is no comfort at all. I mean, those donors are getting some great value from that connection to Trump,
in that it would cost a whole lot less to build than that. Where does the frosting go? The whipped cream, so to speak. Once again, there's nobody keeping track. So I have a feeling I know where it will end up.
Yeah.
Just saying.
The other side of this question is, what did it cost to demolish the East Wing? Any idea?
Demolitions, and especially when you're the president in Washington, D.C., if it was a bona fide project in Des Moines or Kansas City or wherever, you would have regulators there, you'd have lead abatement, you'd have, goodness gracious, look at all the materials that are in there. Beautiful windows, incredible high quality materials. I would hope they would be recycling some of it. It looks like it was just track those and dumpsters, you know, so
yeah,
all that
crazy
history, a usable product.
I'm not sure we have a president who believes in recycling.
Yeah, I kind of got that too. Yeah.
So
the budget crunching numbers, it seems to follow through as a pattern through all the proposals and everything I hear about.
Yeah. Hey, so I want to switch gears here. I know we're affordability is a big buzzword these days. You hear it from Trump. What did he say? That he just discovered a new word. I don't know if affordability was a new word for him, but for those of us who live basically paycheck to paycheck, affordability has been a word in our vernacular for a long time. But, it's a buzzword. It may be a campaign theme. I know one specific thing that I know you're concerned about too is air travel. We could talk about what happened with air travel and during the shutdown, but a bigger issue is, to me, how air travel has been so heavily subsidized that it is now more affordable than taking a train, taking a bus even, and oftentimes driving, even long distance. And now they're talking about another way to make air travel more affordable, and at the same time throwing out the sustainability card by switching to environmentally friendly jet fuel alternatives to what they currently burn. And one of those is rendered animal fat. One of your favorite subjects, I know, is rendered animal fat.
They all seem to be a thin covering on reality. I've heard of algae being used to make in Iowa. I wanted to invest in it. That actually sounded reasonable, but it's private, of course. Types of biofuels, soy, ethanol, that kind of stuff, sure. Those are all heavily subsidized, as far as I'm concerned. And they don't stand on their own. And by the way, so there it is on the face. Rendered animal fat. Okay, it comes from animals for one thing. So basically I'm going to connect some dots here. You're grinding up living beings to make jet fuel. Animal production, CAFOs, all that kind of stuff. Huge impact on the environment. And by the way, okay, so maybe we have this miracle of actual sustainable jet fuel. Airports are ridiculous energy monsters.
Just the airport itself, you mean?
Oh, everything about them.
Yeah.
So what was it? Animal production, I heard somewhere between 15 and 20% of carbon emissions in the world are from that. Their argument against parts of it were it's not sustainable if the cattle are raised on rainforest lands that have been deforested. I'm like, oh,
well, that's
wait
a
minute. That's your issue.
Yeah. That's a really good point. There was a recent story from, I think, just a couple months ago in Reuters about a Texas refinery that is beginning to supply so-called, quote, green fuel to, U.S. airline companies. And it's been getting the animal fat that it used to make that fuel from cattle raised on land in the Amazon that has been illegally cleared, cleared forests. And
so that was the riff. And you're like, wait a minute, even in the best scenario, we're in Iowa, right? I don't know if you've heard of some Iowa water quality problems.
Oh, yeah.
it's like there's the cattle and there's the fat, and then there's the chain, the spider web of everything that comes with it. So the sustainable jet fuel is responsible for partially responsible for 20,000 square mile dead zone in the Gulf.
Yeah.
The raping of the soil in Iowa, the water quality, nitrates, cancer levels, come on. It's sustainable. No, not, but and it's really using animal fat. That's to me, that's like on a chicken farm, you're raising eggs, you take all the male chickens, you put them in a hopper, you grind them up and get rid of them. That's the level of sustainability and empathy and thought we're talking about.
We have a shared dislike of industrial scale, factory farming, I think that's
it's fallout too. It's not just that. Once again, it's all connected to a whole bunch of other stuff.
Right, but I mean, to me, there are ways of sustainably raising animals that are actually good for the environment. Deforesting the Amazon, cutting down the Amazon forest, rainforest, and raising cattle there is not one of them.
By the way, soybeans too.
Sure, yeah.
So China's going to buy it from new market, chopped up more rainforest.
Brazil and Argentina, yeah.
We have mountains of them here, but never mind why we can't get from point A to point B. That would get us back where we started.
Let me ask you this, Mark. I mean, I'm a big fan of train travel. In Europe, it's just great to be able to travel from, one end of France, for example, to the other in hardly any time at all, railing along at 200 miles an hour. But to get the U.S. rail system to a comparable level is what we see in Europe, Japan, and even more so China. It's estimated that it would cost up to $3 trillion. And that's it. That is a lot of money. I will point out that it's only three times as much as Elon Musk is now planning to make at Tesla. face it, it's not a matter it's very doable. We could have high-speed rail travel, and you could go from New York to Washington, oh, sorry, New York to Los Angeles in what, just a matter of a couple of days
or less. Can I do the spider whip thing again, though?
Go ahead.
In Europe, for example, my daughter did a study abroad in Valencia, so we fly over there to Madrid. Yeah, transit, rail, that kind of stuff. Got off, we walked to the Airbnb with our suitcases. You're not going to do that here. You're going to get off the train in LA. You're going to need to do a cab, an Uber, every single time you do everything, because the cities are laid out for non-sustainable vehicles. Once again, okay, now we got EVs. Back to the spider web thing. Yeah, well, those EVs are on a ridiculously carbon-heavy infrastructure, concrete, asphalt, power lines, traffic lights, everything. Everything about it is non-sustainable. You take one aspect of it and you improve it a little bit. By the way, that electricity doesn't come from ferries, and it comes from energy sources that are also using carbon energy, blah, 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 blah. It's you're looking at the tip of an iceberg, and there's not going to be icebergs for long.
Well, that's a different topic. Yeah. So let me as an architect, and maybe this is beyond your purview, but do you see the estimated cost of between $1 and $3 trillion as a reasonable estimate to build a complete, you know, passenger rail system, a high-speed rail system in the U.S.?
Okay, so that's only part of the equation. Weakest link and all that. The city near me, I'm not going to mention it, had a sustainability study done. The consultants for $150,000 told them if they spent $3.3 billion, they could have a sustainable city, which seemed a little ironic to me. You got to consume to be sustainable. The one word that was not mentioned in the entire report was sprawl. Not only would that not cost the city money, that is their single biggest expense is transportation and transportation-related costs. So eliminating sprawl makes mass transit far more affordable, far more cost-effective,
right. And
it makes things like high-speed rail work, because when I get somewhere, I can walk to my hotel. I can take my suitcase on wheels or whatever.
Yeah.
The whole city is set up for that. Here you get here and you're kind of dumped out into, oh, now you get to deal with this.
Hmm.
Well, guess what? Americans don't do that. They want a car. I can get my car. I can go there. I can park in the parking lot of the hotel. I'm done.
And we want to fly, and we want to fly when we want to fly, and we want to get there as fast as possible. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I think it's important to recognize, too, that I think the main obstacles to high-speed rail in the U.S. are, you know, car, and actually this is from Wikipedia, car dependency induced by the highway lobby. You know, that kind of sums it up. But beyond that, people want to get there now, and they want to get there fast.
I'm going to call it conspiracy for lack of, it's really a concerted effort. It's kind of corporatism. The tire people, the automo people, the oil and gas people came in. They bought up the transit lines. They used to have them in Kansas City. They used to have a whole bunch of the places.
Right. Yep.
They bought them up and they tore them out for their market share, cornering the market. Now, you don't have this other option now. You are going to drive. You're going to use tires. You're going to use gas. You're going to buy cars.
Or you're going to fly.
The economy, yeah. But horrible for the cities. They're the ones basically subsidizing all that profit.
Yeah, Mark, I think, you know, again, the bottom line for me is that Americans want it all, and they want it now. And, you know, with the highway lobby in place, it's a hard road, a hard trail to travel to see us getting to high-speed rail, but I think it's doable. Well, Mark, hey, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. Mark Klipsham, folks. Back in a minute with more conversation here on the Fallon Forum.
Hey, Daddy, I want a golden goose.
Here we go again.
All right, sweetheart, all right. Daddy will get you a golden goose as soon as we get home.
No, I want one of those.
Bunker, how much do you want for the golden goose?
They're not for sale.
Name your price.
She can't have one.
Who says I can't?
The man with the funny hat.
I want one. I want a golden goose.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks again to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. All right, so, you know, things are getting very interesting. Last week I told you that I think the new leader of the de facto Trump resistance is Marjorie Taylor Greene. And this week, Marjorie Taylor Greene announced she's resigning. And I never thought I'd say this, but Marjorie, I'm sorry to see you go. You were just starting to, you know, stand up to policies that were not part of the Trump agenda. You know, you were a big supporter of this guy. And now he's dismissed you. He's unendorsed you. He's made, basically, he's made it possible for, or more appealing for people in the mega base to threaten you, and they are doing that. And I understand why Greene is resigning. You know, she's on the outs. She's getting death threats. I get it. I understand. And just to be sure, folks, you know this, that she represents the most Republican district in the state of Georgia. She was probably going to win that seat back again, despite Trump, but it will certainly not be a Democratic seat with her gone. That said, I think that the Democrats have real prospects for controlling not just the House but the U.S. Senate, and I was pleased to see that perspective, one that I have espoused for a while, is being talked about in the New York Times, and specifically Iowa being mentioned because of the strong candidacy being proposed on the Democratic side, which I can't talk too much about here because this is an FCC-regulated program. But, you know, you have other states around the country where U.S. Senate seats are in play, and Iowa is certainly one of them with the retirement of Joni Ernst. And you've got, again, the House obviously is in play, which is why Republicans have been trying really hard to create a gerrymandering nightmare for Democrats. And, you know, that whole thing has been up and down. I mean, with Texas proposing 5 seats that would be more or less comfortable for Republicans. And yet the district court saying, no, that doesn't wash. The Supreme Court then coming and saying, no, it's okay. This is a pinball game. It goes back and forth. And who knows where it's going to land. It might land in favor of the Democrats, despite Republican efforts to gerrymander the nation in a way that it benefits them. It's hard to say. Bottom line is, even if Republicans win the gerrymandering war, which I think is, again, the whole thing is detestable. It's horrible. If they happen to win that war, Democrats still have a fairly reasonable chance of gaining enough seats to win back the U.S. House. So beyond all those things, these things are not going well for Donald Trump. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene's, even though she is going to resign, the fact that she has made all this noise about Trump not sticking with the agenda that he promised, you know, she's planted a bunch of seeds. And not that there haven't been other people already speaking out against what Trump's been doing, but now you've got a sitting congresswoman you know, making it really clear that, yeah, it's okay to challenge the dictator in chief. and so we'll see where that goes. And she may still be a voice outside of the system calling for reform, or at least challenging where Trump is taking things. But I have a suspicion she's I suspect that she's so concerned about her safety that she might just shut up. And I get that. But there are other reasons why Trump is losing support. And here's one. This is a story I talked about in this program back in, I think, July or August when it broke. And I don't know why it doesn't get more play here in the U.S. media, but there's a great story about it in the Irish Times last week. It talks about Jim Brown and his wife, Donna Hughes Brown. She is she's Irish. She was born in England, two Irish parents. And they moved to the U.S. back when she was 11. Okay, so she's been here for, 47 years. She's a green card holder, and she's married to Jim Brown, who's a conservative Republican. And I mean, he's a military man. You know, he's a country guy. He says, quote, "I grew up dirt poor and literally came through abuse and the whole nine yards. I joined the military, was highly successful in the military, and also very successful in my private life. Lived the American dream, and they took it away from me. For nothing." And when he says, when Jim Brown says they took it away from him, they're referring to what they did to his wife. So he and Donna went to Ireland. I think it was for a funeral. Anyway, they were in Ireland. And when they came back and landed at O'Hare Airport, the ICE agents were there waiting for them. And they refused to let Jim accompany his wife. They took her away. And he was told that she had to sign some paperwork and would be on the next flight home to St. Louis. That's where they were going from Ireland to Chicago to St. Louis and then driving from St. Louis to the ranch they live on in Missouri. So Jim Brown says that he waited patiently for Donna to call me to pick her up after her flight. But ICE went ahead and detained her. And they stuck her in a van, drove her to a facility in Kentucky. She's been detained there ever since July. This is November now, late November. She is still a prisoner in Kentucky. And the allegation is that, well, she was a criminal. Well, let's look at her crime record. Yeah, her criminal record involved writing two, quote, bad checks at a local grocery store during a time of extreme hardship years ago. It was about 10 years ago, I guess. And the total of those checks was less than $60. And most importantly, she repaid that amount. So that's her criminal record. You know, that's the equivalent of running a traffic light, you know, or failing to have a seatbelt on. That's how bad that is, right? And that's the excuse that ICE used to detain her and to send her to a facility in Kentucky, several hundred miles, 500 miles from Missouri, where she's been and in bad condition. I mean, I talked about the condition she's in before. And Jim talks to his wife every day for about 15 minutes, and he says, it doesn't sound good. I mean, and the conditions basically are inhumane. Now, Jim is finally getting some traction. He said, over 100 officials in Missouri, got nowhere. Finally got some traction from some Democratic lawmakers who invited him to come testify before a hearing. It wasn't a hearing authorized by the Republican majority in the House, but the Democrats had invited him and several other detainees, people who were either on track to be deported or had been deported with very, very questionable situations. And his wife was one of them. The bottom line is more and more Americans are going to be seeing that a lot of people who are being caught up in the ICE web are not the worst of the worst, as Trump called them. They're not the criminals. And I'm sorry, writing a bad check, never good, understand why it happened. Glad you repaid it. We're done. But no, I guess if you're Stephen Miller, again, Trump's henchman, who wants to see 3,000 deportations a day, you know, you're gonna have to come after not just black and brown people, which again is most of the targeted population, but maybe some Irish people as well. Maybe someone who isn't a rapist or a killer or a murderer or a drug dealer, but a bad check, you know? So this is where we're at. And Jim Brown, again, lifelong Republican, rural American, gun owner, honorable military veteran, is saying, I cannot believe what's happening. This is not what we voted for. No way am I ever going to shut up and support this. And how many more Americans are beginning to see that that's what this is about? This is not about you know, cracking down on the worst of the worst. This is about Trump, with the guidance of Stephen Miller, meeting a quota to appear to be tough on immigration. It may also be about, you know, trying to make America safe for people that Trump believes in, people that Trump likes. And again, you know, I'm guessing that there aren't a lot of Irish people on the list of deportees, but I do know that there are plenty of Irish Americans who may not have full citizenship that are being very careful right now, and they have reason to be. Folks, this is Ed Fallon with you on the Fallon Forum. We'll be back in a minute. Kathy Burns joining me to talk about the favorite Thanksgiving side dishes across our country.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
All right, here, folks, Ed Fallon with you. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. Hey, Kathy Burns, welcome to the program. And I hear you have something different and maybe a little bit mischievous planned for our farm and food segment today.
Are you ready for a pop quiz?
Oh, shoot. Okay. I pull this stuff on Charles all the time. I guess it's my turn to be the victim.
Well, Campbell's Soup does a yearly survey, and I'm not a buyer of Campbell's Soup products, but I did grow up on some of their casseroles and things like that, the recipes. And every year the survey is what's the most popular Thanksgiving side dish in each state. Okay. So they determined this. I was worried about using Campbell's Soup data because I thought it would all be stuff made with Campbell's Soup. But they
it's not. Okay.
They base this on a survey of 5,000 Americans across every state. They determine the most popular side dish.
A lot of time and money spent on something fairly frivolous, but go for it.
Well, I think it's odd that it comes down to basically five side dishes.
All right.
But
do your worst.
I'm going to give you the name of a state, and these are states that have members of our family.
Okay.
In them.
Is this multiple choice?
And you can guess. No, I'm not. I'm just going to let you try to imagine what the most popular side dish would be.
All right.
We'll start with where we are right now, Iowa. What do you think the most popular side dish for Thanksgiving is, according to Campbell's Soup Survey, in Iowa?
Bean casserole.
That has been determined the most popular side dish by some other surveys and in some other news stories. But Campbell's Soup says that mashed potatoes.
That was my second guess. Okay.
Mashed potatoes.
All right.
And it has actually edged out the green bean casserole.
Well, that's a good thing. I never liked that green bean casserole
very
much.
From previous years. Okay. So let's go to Oregon. Most popular Thanksgiving side dish in Oregon.
Oh, boy. Mary and Berry pie? That's what? the only place in the country I've had that.
What is that?
It's like a blackberry-ish sort of fruit, but I know it's wrong.
Oh, okay. It is wrong. According to the survey, it is stuffing. Let's go down to Florida.
All right.
And see if you can determine what that most popular side dish is.
Fish. is that too broad?
It's not a fish product.
Okay.
It's mac and cheese.
Oh, gosh.
And
you can do better than that.
That is gaining popularity more nationwide.
I'm going to go with mashed potatoes.
Okay. We don't tend to serve that. I like homemade mac and cheese in other circumstances. Let's go to Arizona and see if you can figure out what...
prickly pear cactus salad. No, that's not it. Guacamole.
It is the stuffing again.
The stuffing again. All right. Well,
yeah.
I guess I don't consider that a side dish, but I suppose it is. It's inside the bird, and then it becomes on the side of your plate. So I guess it's a side dish. Yeah.
That's a good point. Let's go to Massachusetts.
Cranberry sauce.
I have seen that as the most popular in some other surveys, but according to Campbell's, it's once again the stuffing.
Boring. I'm gonna call my guess right there.
So the five most popular overall have been determined as either stuffing or dressing. I'm still not sure of the difference. Mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes hasn't come up for any of our purposes yet.
And we're serving sweet potato pie from our own sweet potatoes on Thanksgiving.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
And the other one is, the other two are mac and cheese and the green bean casserole. So why don't you call out a state real quick and we'll do one more.
Minnesota.
Let's see. Again, stuffing. So stuffing reigns supreme.
What about Michigan?
As the popular side dish. In Michigan, it is, again, stuffing.
Okay. Well, that's not surprising, but... I see a kind of a movement away from regional favorites.
I think the differences come, the versatility of these dishes come in what recipe is being used. For instance, you made sweet potato pie the other day, and you're going to make it for Thanksgiving from our own sweet potatoes. And a sweet potato pie made from the Better Homes and Gardens recipe is going to be vastly different than somebody in Alabama making their own local favorite.
Yeah. All right, so stuffing, the most popular side dish across the U.S. for the most part, except here in Iowa. Mashed potatoes, yes.
That's correct. And mashed potato recipes vary slightly from state to state, but not as much as stuffing.
Yeah, all right. Well, hey, happy Thanksgiving, folks. I'd like to thank my guests today, Frank County and Mark Clipsham. Also, a thanks to our production squad of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, of course, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds of Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Have a great Thanksgiving, folks.